Cloudera jumping 13% after announcing its merger with Hortonworks. It's an all-stock deal worth $5.2 billion, and under the terms of this transaction, Cloudera stockholders will own approximately 60% of the equity of the combined company.
Reuters sources say Russia and Saudi Arabia struck a deal last month to quietly increase their oil production, and they notified the United States that they were doing so. But the agreement was kept quiet because publicly, they have refused to bow to demands from the White House to do exactly that, increase production, before the November midterm elections.
General Motors getting some help in the race to get a self-driving car on the market. Wednesday, announcing Honda will fork over $2 billion for a stake in Cruise, GM's self-driving unit. The investment underscoring how costly it is for automakers to work on an emerging technology that has yet to prove itself.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Thursday. It's October 4th, and it's 5:11 in the morning. Thank you for being with us again this morning for another edition of The Opening Bell, and another business day getting underway on the broadcast today. A little bit later in the show, Heather Long will be here from The Washington Post. We're going to dive into the new NAFTA, the replacement for NAFTA, what's in it, what's good, what's bad, where do we go from here. Heather is an economics reporter at The Washington Post, and she'll be on with us at about 5:40, so you don't want to miss that this morning. It's also Thought Leader Thursday. And this morning, Doug Myers is here from Associated Bank. We're going to talk a little bit about banking trends and millennials. What do millennials want out of the banking systems that they use? And how does that impact all of the rest of us going forward? Doug will join us momentarily. First on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, shares fell in Asia today despite a strong day yesterday on Wall Street that was spurred on by signs of hiring in the private job market. The ADP report yesterday was very strong ahead of the big jobs report tomorrow. This morning in the rest of Asia, though, we'll see the Nikkei end down about 0.5%, nearly 135 points. The Hang Seng off more than 460 points, down more than 1.75%. The Shanghai is up about 1%, up about 29 points. In Europe this morning, markets are generally lower as well, with the markets in France and in London down by more than 1%, and in Germany by about 0.5%. And in the United States, futures are pointing toward opening losses on Wall Street. Dow futures are down 105 points. That's about 1/3. S&P futures are off nearly 0.5%, and NASDAQ futures are off more than 0.5% this morning, down 47 points. Oil is trading at $76.29 a barrel, which is up about 11 cents. A couple of stories before we begin with Doug this morning. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell says he believes the central bank's current pace of gradually hiking interest rates is the right policy, and criticism from President Trump has not altered that approach. Powell says that even with the Fed's third hike this year, rates are at a low level that's still boosting economic growth. He says the Fed was prepared to go past neutral to a level that is restraining growth if necessary, but he notes at the moment rates are a long way from neutral. Amazon made a big splash this week with its $15 an hour minimum wage announcement, but lost in the fine print. Existing warehouse workers will no longer receive stock in company or collect bonuses in the company, stock in the company or collect bonuses. The online giant says next month it'll end bonuses, which paid workers extra based on their attendance and warehouse productivity as it's boosts its minimum wage. That money will go to pay for the minimum wage increase. Amazon will also phase out its restricted stock unit program, which gave shares to workers if they stayed at Amazon for a certain number of years. It's Thought Leader Thursday here on the Opening Bell. Doug Myers is along. He's the SVP and Private Banking Regional Manager at Associated Bank. Doug, good morning. Welcome back to the Opening Bell.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you.
Let's begin with some news out there. I know we've on past Thought Leader conversations have talked about this, but the Federal Reserve is wanting to broaden the number of banks receiving regulatory relief, changing some classifications. How big of a deal is this? Is this on your radar screen?
It's a big deal. The administration for the past, 18 months now, has changed the regulations from Dodd-Frank, which was passed in the Obama administration. And what it's done, it's created different tier levels for the different regulatory rules that banks are under. And before, it was up to $50 billion banks had a certain regulatory environment, and over $50 billion, it was more restrictive, so to speak. And it goes to the fact that the administration wanted to create protection for banks, too big to fail, so to speak. And so what they've done is the banks that are $50 billion and above, they changed that to $250 billion in assets and over. They put different regulations than the $50 billion and under banks. And that has helped most of the banks in this country to be more profitable. It's lowered the regulatory cost. It changes their liquidity coverage ratios, which means the banks have enough money to cover a month's worth of liabilities, so to speak, to make sure it doesn't fail within the 30 days. It's also changed the trading restriction rules, leverage ratios, the CFPB, which monitored Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which monitored consumer behavior and the banks, how they regulated the consumer behaviors, have changed. So there's been a lot of action on the bank regulations.
Has this impacted Associated or any other banks that we would all be familiar with here in the Chicago area?
It has. And Associated Bank is in that range under $50 billion. And we were looking at making some acquisitions, and we've made some acquisitions, but the goal was to stay under the $50 billion, because once you pass that amount, it changes the regulatory environment for us. Well, now that that's changed to $250 billion, we have some room to grow and look at some acquisitions. We've made three or four recently in the past year. We've bought an insurance company. We bought a registered investment advisory firm. We bought a savings and loan in Milwaukee. And so it has changed the way we do business, and it's eased up the regulations a little bit for us to grow and be a little more profitable.
It's something that consumers will notice or no?
I think they will notice the increased presence of a bank like ours. I think other banks it gives them more profitability to grow. It gives them a little more profitability to introduce new products and manufacture financial products to the consumer. So I think it's a good thing. It also makes them more profitable, and that's important. You know, the capital requirements are going to be more, I think, a little bit less restrictive and help the banks grow a little more.
I know in past conversations with you, we've talked about all of the bureaucracy and red tape. I know that back before the last election, we were hoping that some of that would be taken away. Is all of that coming to fruition, or at least some of that coming to fruition?
It is. There's been a lot of change. And and I mentioned the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and that is an example, has changed leadership. It's changed its philosophy. It's changed in how they operate and how they monitor banks and how they deal with consumers.
Consumers might ask if this is at all putting banks in a position where we could be back in another 2008 situation. Are there enough safeguards in place aside from these regulations to prevent that, do you think?
I think so. That's certainly up for discussion. But I think with the new capital requirements, the new liquidity requirements, the new rules on proprietary trading that the banks have initiated, they call that the Volcker Rule, and that's still in place. So I think that there's enough safeguards in place, and there's still enough regulation in place that it'll allow the banks to have a little more freedom, but at the same time protect the banks. And we don't want a situation where there's too big to fail, and that's what created the domino effect in the 2008 you were referring to.
You talked about growth, mentioned some mergers and acquisitions and product growth. What would the last part of that look like with product development, things going on besides mergers and acquisitions? What does that growth look like?
Well, I think anytime banks merge, it creates new products. It creates a new environment for technology. You know, we've talked about technology a lot. And if you're a community bank, and there's still over 5,000 community banks in this country, you really don't have the wherewithal and the capital base to spend a lot of money on technologies like a Chase, for example, or Bank of America and Wells Fargo, because they're the big boys and they can spend a lot of money on technology, where the smaller banks can't. And that's, you have to be able to keep up with technology to maintain your consumer base. And I think the mergers will help that, and it creates bigger scope to be able to spend money on technology and offer the products that consumers want.
Along the lines of rebranding, along the lines of making some changes with technology, especially. There was a story recently, wealthmanagement.com, about trying to rebrand some of the things that banks do because, I don't know, younger folks might think some of it's a little stodgy. It doesn't have the kind of technology, perhaps, that they're using. How important is it to keep pace with those younger generations? And I know we've had the conversations about millennials a lot on the program, but how important is it to keep this all fresh and new for people that are just coming up into these ranks?
Well, I think it's huge. And I think if you look at the millennial population, they certainly do business differently than maybe our generation does. And I think as you look at what they're using in terms of the Venmos and the PayPals and the Zelles for payments. And that's just one example of how they operate and use the payment system, where that's outside of traditional banking. And I think, you know, the Amazons of the world are getting into banking. And so I think as technology continues to evolve, I think there's going to be a lot of companies like this that offer traditional banking services to the millennials that aren't within banks.
In part of the story talked about finance losing its coolness factor. Do you feel like you're a little less cool than maybe a year or two ago?
Well, I don't think I've ever felt like I'm cool as a banker.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, the environment has changed, and banking certainly has changed in the past, I would say, 10 years, but certainly the last, you know, 5 years, it's going at a dramatic pace. And you look at all the financial companies that are getting into the space of transferring funds and these sort of things. It's just creating a whole new world for electronics. And you look at mobile banking, for example. We spend a lot of time and effort and money on our mobile product. And, you know, a large percentage of people now bank with their phones. And the technology is ever evolving. It evolves rapidly. And it's very expensive to maintain a platform like that. And banks have to do that and keep up because the millennials are using digital like never before.
I'm going to segue into some of the things. There was another article, too, about, a couple of different things that banks can avoid doing to make the mistake of turning off millennials. One of them is to sort of become like a one-stop shopping hub for all things financial for somebody. Is that something that Associated Bank has been trying to do?
Well, we certainly want to have a client come in and offer them a full solution set of products. I think that as banks continue to evolve, I think the one-stop shop makes a lot of sense on paper. I'm not so sure it works all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's a very fragmented business, and especially with all these new firms coming on, I think it's a real challenge for us to stay relevant.
Is that the Holy Grail? Because the story that I found does say that to having that one app that does everything that all of these Venmos and other places do, it would be the Holy Grail for banks if they could come up with that.
You know, I think that's still in unknown territory, to be honest with you. I think banks have tried to be the one-stop shop. It hasn't necessarily worked. I think of Citigroup, for one example. You know, combined all their financial services into their one company. And because of the recession and other things, that blew up and that model didn't really work. And so I think as we try to take care of our customers, we try to be a holistic provider of all the financial services, but it's very competitive out there. And some things we can do very well and some things others can do better, quite honestly. And we're trying to certainly figure out how to maintain that market share and to do more with our clients. And that's a real challenge for us.
The millennials have big hopes for artificial intelligence. The story says that they want all of this to be intuitive. They want the artificial intelligence to pay their bills out of their bank account, to invest their money, to send them alerts when their accounts are running low. Is that even possible? Is that where we're headed, that we have artificial intelligence running all of this?
We'll see. I still say that when I look at our wealth management clients, they want that one-on-one relationship. You know, where we add value is where we can help them maintain their dreams and goals, their financial goals. And I think that, once again, artificial intelligence, it's going to evolve. But I think right now it's so important to have that one-on-one relationship and that human touch. Millennials certainly have a different way of looking at that. And I think as they become older and more wealthy, I think that there's probably going to be something to artificial intelligence. But I think it has a ways to go to replace the one-on-one human interaction that we can provide.
Yeah, and before we came on the air this morning, we were talking just amongst some of us here in the studio, all of us not millennials today, about this. And that is, you know, we're kind of uncomfortable using the Venmos and the PayPals and the Apple Pays. And so I still value the one-on-one. That has to still exist for people like us, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And we're glad of that. But I think it's our challenge as a bank to maintain the proper technology advantage, so to speak, that we can still offer our clients what they need in a holistic way.
Yeah. One of the other things, and I think this goes for millennials and other demographics, everybody wants some kind of perk, whether it be points, more money from more interest on our savings, something that would be a perk kind of situation. Are we going back to that now that banks are back on solid footing, where we get these kinds of perks and stuff from not necessarily the toaster for opening an account, but something?
Yes, I think so. And I think it's all about value. I think it's all about what we can do to add value to our clients and their financial picture and their financial wherewithal. And it's that adding value, once again, I go back to that human interaction. That's how we're going to set ourselves apart from the rest, is adding value to their financial relationship.
Doug, good conversation this morning. I know you have been struggling with a little bit of a cold this morning, so we appreciate you coming in and hauling for us this morning.
Thank you very much, Steve.
We'll see you next time.
Doug Myers is the SVP and Private Banking Regional Manager at Associated Bank. It's our thought leader conversation. We'll have more with Doug after the bell, and we'll post that in the podcast of our broadcast later this morning at WGNradio.com on the opening bell page. This is the opening bell on 720 WGN.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Thursday edition of the opening bell. Earlier this week, the United States and Canada came to agreement on a new North American trade agreement, one that already includes Mexico. After a couple of days of going through what's in it and what's not, we thought we'd bring in Heather Long, economics correspondent at the Washington Post this morning, to give us a sense of where things are different, where things might be the same. Heather, good morning. Welcome back to the opening bell.
Hi, Steve. Always good to be here.
Can't wait to talk to you about this, because it is kind of confusing to know what's in this, what's different from NAFTA, and where things go forward. What would you say is the biggest thing that we should have? What's the biggest takeaway from this agreement?
I would say there's three key areas that change from the original NAFTA. Number one is we're now have rules for the digital economy. Obviously, cell phones weren't very prevalent in 1993 and 1994 when this originally went into effect. So there was just a lot of rules that needed to be updated for the 2018. And so a lot of people are pretty happy about those changes. The second big change is there's a lot increased labor and environmental standards. And that's why you see a lot of Democrats, including Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, coming out and saying that they think some of the provisions in this revised agreement are substantially better, because the original agreement didn't have a lot of labor and environmental protections, and the ones it did stipulate didn't have good enforcement mechanisms. And then the third change that I think is the biggest change and that people are talking the most about is these new rules for cars and trucks, and what needs to happen in order for a car and a truck to still be duty-free, not face any tariffs in the NAFTA zone. And that's that increase to 75% of a vehicle must be made in Canada, Mexico, and the United States. That's up from 62.5%. So again, trying to bring more jobs to the region versus going to China or South Korea. And then the second provision is that at least 40% of a vehicle must be made by workers making $16 an hour. So that's really an attempt by the White House to try to prevent more jobs from going from Canada and the United States to lower-paying Mexico, where the wage is more like $3 to $4 in a lot of those auto assembly lines.
Yeah, the auto parts of this, that would seem like good news, because it would, it seems, require some of these manufacturing plants to remain where they're at, to be focused on North America. The $16 an hour aspect of that is pretty positive as well. What are going to be some of the challenges of pushing this forward? Is this something that Mexico likes and that Canada likes and that we will see actually come to fruition?
I think there's a really good chance it does come to fruition. It'll take a long time. This won't go into effect next month or even by the end of the year. The leaders from Canada and Mexico are fully ready to sign this at the end of November. They have to wait about 60 days and technically in order to get together and have the signing ceremony. But after that, it actually takes another roughly year before this will go into effect, because Congress technically has to approve the deal. And there will inevitably be some wrangling. There will inevitably be some debate. More than likely, if in the midterm election happens and Democrats take control of the House, they're not going to make this a particularly easy process for President Trump. So when you read the agreement, the new text, most of the provisions are scheduled to take effect in January 2020. So it will be a while before any of this is actually the new law.
There's also been a lot of discussion among farmers about what this does with agriculture. U.S. farmers are going to get more access to the Canadian dairy market. That was a big sticking point, I believe, in getting Canada to come on to this agreement. How big of a deal is this for U.S. farmers?
It was a huge sticking point, and it was something that sources tell me right up to the very last hours they were going through line by line, in particular the dairy section. The White House did get a little bit of a victory here, not just access to dairy, but also eggs and poultry. There's a little bit more access for U.S. farmers to sell into Canada. There is some applause, I think, for farming communities, at least that I've talked to and heard, as they begin to really walk through that section. Some people point out that, look, if you really dig into the details, in the dairy section, the United States dairy farmers now get to sell about 3.5% more than they were before into Canada. So, look, that translates to probably $60-70 million more worth a year. That's not nothing. If you're a farmer in Wisconsin or my home state of Pennsylvania, you're pretty happy about this. However, in the deal that Trump backed out of, known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so when the very first week when he took office, he withdrew the United States from that deal, the U.S. farmers would have gotten to sell about 3.25% into Canada. So again, they got a little bit better, but some people are saying, was it really worth this long, protracted fight with our close ally to get only a tad more?
Yeah, and that's one of the questions I have for you, Heather, and I don't know if you can answer it or not. It may be something that only Canada knows, but how will they view us going forward? Because as you mentioned, this was kind of a tough fight between us and Canada, and there were some words said. Is this something that they'll be able to forgive us for and we'll be able to work together going forward, or will there be bad blood?
It's still bad blood. And you could see it, the president, one of my colleagues at the Washington Post reported how the President Trump was at a dinner at his hotel in Washington, D.C. Just a few days before this agreement was finalized. And he was really bad-mouthing the Canadian side. He was saying that their chief negotiator, Chrystia Freeland, he, quote, hates America. So there's still no love between Trudeau and Trump. And I think the real test to watch is in the next 60 days, the Canadian side wants the United States, wants President Trump to lift the steel tariff. So we still have, despite coming to this NAFTA agreement, Trump did not remove the steel and aluminum tariffs that are on Canada. Trudeau has called those insulting, totally illegal, unfair. And so if those don't get removed, that's a really good sign that that bad blood isn't going away.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I think, isn't there even a loophole in this agreement that allows those tariffs to continue?
Kind of, yeah. So they didn't do anything with them. They literally just said that's a separate issue. We're not addressing it now.
The president said this is the biggest trade deal in the history of the United States in the United States history. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but how does this lay going forward with some other trade negotiations that are going to be happening with other countries? Is this sort of a banner for what we can expect with those fights as well?
That's what they're saying. The White House is calling this a playbook, that it is a roadmap for what they want to do with Europe and in particular with China. They are laser focused on China now. I think what's interesting, I take away two things from this. Number one, when you really get into the details, Washington Post published a piece on this yesterday morning. When you start to really look closely, you see a lot of wins for big business. So there's some wins for pharmaceuticals, some wins for tech companies, some wins for energy companies. And so lobbyists are really happy at the idea that the United States and negotiators might try to take those wins for big business and put them in agreements, particularly with China. I think for me, the bigger picture takeaway as I look through and read this agreement and reported on it is it's very clear the biggest win here in the White House's eyes and a lot of people's eyes are those auto rules. And the White House really thinks that they got something for manufacturing workers, for blue-collar workers, that they could hold up and say, this is what we did for Trump country. And I think the mistake that China has been making in these negotiations is so far China has offered to buy more agricultural products and to buy more energy. And that, you know, that could be a big change, but the White House keeps saying that's not enough, and I think China needs to recognize they are going to have to put something on the table that looks like a win for manufacturing sector
all
in
right.
the United States.
Heather, thank you for being with us this morning. This is good stuff, and I feel like I know more than I did just a few minutes ago about this. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Heather Long, economics correspondent at the Washington Post. Make sure you follow her on Twitter as well, by Heather Long. And follow all of her stuff over at WashingtonPost.com as well.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures are pointing toward opening losses on Wall Street. Dow futures are down 99 points. That's about a third. NASDAQ futures off about 50, down 0.5%. S&P futures are off almost 0.5%. Gold and silver trading lower as well. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. A lot of red on the market screens yesterday. Weather concerns not helping the corn and soybean market because there is concern that rains could delay the harvest. But there was some technical selling in both livestock and grains at the end of the day. December wheat was down 4 cents a bushel, December corn down 3 cents, November soybeans down 4.25 cents. And in livestock trade, the lean hog contract, December, down $2.12 a hundredweight, October live cattle down 60 cents, and October feeder cattle ended the day down $1.27. We had a good day yesterday at World Dairy Expo in Madison, Wisconsin, a good crowd, and despite the financial concern in the dairy industry, there seemed to be some upbeat thinking. Last night, the recognition of the award honorees at a special banquet, and the Dairyman of the Year, Pete Kappelman from Meadow Brook Dairy Farms in Two Rivers, Wisconsin, the Dairy Woman of the Year, Jeanette Sheehan from Rochester, Minnesota. And they also honored some of the foreign members who are at World Dairy Expo, particularly one individual from China. But the World Dairy Expo continues through Saturday evening when they pick the Supreme Grand Champion Dairy Female. That'll be at about 5 o'clock. Saturday evening. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. One other story before we leave you this morning. The board of Barnes & Noble says it's reviewing the company's future after several parties expressed interest in buying it. The company says it's appointing a special committee to review potential buying offers and could be up for sale very quickly. One of the interested parties is its founder and chairman, who's credited with turning Barnes & Noble into a superstore, Leonard Riggio. The bookseller has long been struggling with increasing competition from Amazon, has been reducing staff over the last year. Riggio owns about 19% of the company and is its largest shareholder. He says he'll vote in favor of any transaction recommended by the committee. The New York-based company says it's adopting a shareholder rights plan after noticing an unidentified party rapidly accumulating its stock. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Thursday, October 4th. The Commerce Department releases its August report on factory orders today. Freddie Mac reports on this week's average mortgage rates. The Challenger Job Cut Report is out today. We'll also get another report on natural gas from EIA. Also, the Fed balance sheet report due out. Money supply data on the earnings calendar. Constellation Brands, ticker symbol STZ. Has earnings today, as well as Costco, with the ticker symbol COST, C-O-S-T. So just some of the things that could move the markets on this Thursday. It's October the 4th. Remember, Vic Vaughn has stories that matter coming up from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio, and I'll continue to follow your money right here on 720 WGN and in the Steve Cochran Show, which is next. And I'll be back bright and early tomorrow morning with another edition of The Opening Bell. I'm Steve Brzanich. Have a great day.